Everybody's heard all of the takes, the rage bait, the anger, the fawning critical reviews around Mixtape, and nobody's actually really engaging on the game's own merits in isolation, which is weird because effectively Mixtape has been drawing out all of the other arguments within the space, some of which have been going on for years about what is a game, what is an indie title. And we'll talk a little bit about those later on. But first off, we just want to talk about who is Mixtape for and does it succeed on its own artistic merits? Because that's the talk that nobody's actually having about this game.
Yeah, it is funny going and reading all of the, I think most of it is non-controversy, honestly. There's very little real controversy about this game. There's just a lot of people dredging up things that they're applying to it and arguing about that. But not a lot of talk about the game itself. And I'll say right off, I don't think it's a 10 out of 10 game. I think it's a really good game. I enjoyed it. But to speak to your point of who it's about, it's for people like us who grew up in the 90s, who maybe experienced some of the things that happened in the game, you know, in our own way, who are familiar with all these types of movies like Ferris Bueller's Day Off. It's very much, very obviously, and not hiding it at all, trying to be, you know, a modern version of that type of storyline, right? And that's fine. Like, I think it's fine for people like us that it is fun to kind of dive into nostalgia and hear the music and all that. But I think it's potentially good for people that like don't have any experience with that kind of thing and, you know, want to kind of experience something new too, you know? So I think it's going to find fans that aren't, you know, just in it for the nostalgia. But for people like us where it does hit that nostalgia, it's charming in that way, you know? And I don't think you need to be ashamed to say that, you know?
Yeah, and I also think it's important to note that a lot of the actual artistic criticism that has come around this game has been people engaging with clips online that show these teenagers making these cringe monologues, right? Which, if you're actually familiar with the cinematic inspirations, like you're talking about John Hughes, right?
Yeah.
These 80s, 90s coming of age stories. That is part of them as well, right? They are depicting teenagers who think that every moment is so consequential. And it's not intended for us as the audience to take seriously or clap or whatever people think that you should be doing. The entire purpose is that we are viewing this as an adult looking at a teenager. Right.
Right.
And it is intended to be written as a teenager.
Yeah.
Like it would be more weird, Doa, if we were watching a teenager give a monologue that sounded like it was coming out of the mouth of a 45-year-old adult.
Yes, for sure. And I thought it was, I liked all that because it's supposed to be cringe. It's supposed to be laughable. You know, it is comedy because, yes, of course, these kids are taking everything way too seriously. And it's because they're in high school. And when you are a high schooler, everything seems way more serious than it actually is, you know, because you're at this age where you're starting to finally get this glimpse of the larger world, right? And you're also, you know, going through this huge emotional growth moment, you know, too. And so, yeah, everything seems really big in high school, you know, and you seem very important, but you're not. And the things that you think are important aren't as important as you think they are. But everybody does kind of act that way. And I would say 99% of the people out there that have been high schoolers would be lying if they said that they weren't a little bit like that at some point, you know?
Well, I also think it's funny that, you know, people are taking this game as if you look back on this and you want to be that person. As in, we play this game. And, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
No, like, obviously not.
Hell no, we're laughing at it.
You know, I was playing this on stream and I'm like laughing through some of these speeches. And it doesn't make the game less enjoyable because it brings us back to a time in our own lives. And I don't think that anybody who's an adult, you know, part of the reason why we look back with fondness on our teenage years is because it felt so momentous, right? And we can remember the big emotions and all the emotional highs, right? Because coming with the cringe is also this teenage elation, right? And, you know, the world over time drags you and beats you down, and it makes it so the things that seem really important in a good way, you know, you no longer get that feeling anymore, right? Because you're jaded and you've been beat down with experience. And so part of the draw is to go back to those moments where it felt pure and you had that naivety, right? But the other part of that is just the cringe. And you can't have one without the other. And the nostalgic experience that mixtape is offering is that. It's not that I hope people aren't going back and saying, wow, you know, this is, I identify
life
right
was
now with
then.
This teenager. Like, I don't even understand where this perspective comes from, Doa, because I don't see people of our generation actually saying that. I just see it being claimed about people of our generation.
Yeah, I mean, like, people are like, oh, well, if only I could go back there. It's like, I don't think you really want to, because, like, sure, you know, that there were lots of great things objectively about, you know, lower prices on stuff, you know, blah, blah, blah. But, like, at the same time, you know, as a teenager, you're much more limited in what you can do, you know, on a given day, too. You know, like, it's, you're not you, you know, you haven't grown. So it's, you know, I this game was really fun because it made me think of a lot of the dumb stuff I did when I was a teenager.
Yes.
Some of which I'll be happy to share during this conversation. But, you know, I never once had this like feeling that I wanted to go back there. Right. Like, it's fun to think about and laugh at like the person that I was back then. And there's a certain fondness for like the relationships that you had and the friends and the, you know, the trouble you got into and all that. And, you know, a lot of that really resonated with me as I played the game, because I saw them getting into a lot of like the similar trouble that I got into when I was that age, you know? And so it's fun to have that stoke those own memories, you know? But yeah, this idea that you wish you could just snap your fingers and go back there. I mean, that's like, that's ridiculous, you know?
Or that a teenager says cringe teenage things, and then a bunch of middle-aged millennials and Gen X people are, everybody's clapping for them. It's like, who's clapping? No, nobody, by the way.
Yeah,
anyway,
game is comedy. It's comedy. And if you don't understand that it's comedy, that's, I don't know what to tell you. I will say too, that there was, I think something that people might not understand if they didn't grow up during that direction or during that era is that, it was a time where, like, from the teenage perspective, things seemed pretty good in general. Things seemed fairly peaceful. There were not any big crises like we seem to have every, like, 5 to 10 years now.
Pre-9/11.
Yeah, it was crucially. Pre-9/11. Like, things were, like, truly much more casual and chill in general. But coming out of the, like, raging business success of the 80s into the 90s, a lot of people would call the apathetic 90s, where there was this sort of, like, teenage malaise that was shown in like the grunge movement, things like that, like where, you know, it seemed like the world had it figured out and everything was going to be fine. But then there was no room for heroes. There was no room for, you know, like you to be, you know, everyone's telling you can be a rock star all the time. You can be an astronaut. You can do all these things. Everything just seemed too good, you know, and that had this reverse effect of creating this sort of like apathy, you know, where it's like, well, then I'll, you know, I guess I'm just destined to just like drift through life and everything's peachy, you know, and that it has this weird reverse effect. And I feel like they captured that very well, which if you didn't grow up during those times, you didn't feel that. But if you look at the music, if you look at the media at the time, it's very much there. And I'm not saying all the stuff that happened, you know, 9/11, all that, you know, helped things. But I'm saying that this cultural like zeitgeist existed and definitely did cause people to think and talk the way that they talked in this game, for sure.
Right. And I think you really see that in a couple of films. And an example of what you're talking about, especially on social media, is the movie Office Space, right?
Oh, sure.
And
yeah.
The memes around Office Space today are criticizing Peter, the main character, because he's complaining about having a stable job and not doing very much work. But in this time period, that kind of corporate life felt very stultifying. And people felt during this period that they should be feeling more, right? That the structure was constricting them. You also see this, for example, in Fight Club.
Even in The Matrix.
That's true. Yeah, even in The Matrix as well. It's a really good point. And these, you know, Fight Club, and I think Fight Club was 98, Matrix was 99. I believe Office Space was a little bit earlier. But this was a very common theme that, you know, you were being constricted by safety, effectively.
Or even like a thing like Suburban Commando that we've watched on this show, where it's like the idea that the norm is this quaint, safe suburban life, and we need something to come in and shake it up. And that's what gives us our story. That thing where we need something to shake up the quaint, safe suburban life, that was the general feeling, you know, that I certainly remember growing up with.
And that people couldn't be fulfilled or like emotionally fulfilled by this lifestyle. And now people right. obviously look at that and say, well, we live in a much more chaotic time. I yearn for
yeah,
calmness. Oh,
there is that. Yes. I won't begrudge people for, you know, wishing for a little bit more calmness right now. I think that's a really good point
about media from the era. And yeah. guys, if you want to, I actually do address the controversies on this channel. There's a video essay I released called Why Is Everyone Fighting About Mixtape? That actually goes over this. So go ahead. I'll put it in the description and I'll pin a comment below about that if you want to watch that. But let's actually just talk about the artistic merits of this game, because for me, this is really like a vibes piece. I don't think that the writing is anything exceptional. Like it's very, I think it starts a lot stronger than it ends, and we'll get to the ending of the game and what we think about that. But for me, this is mostly about creating an atmosphere. And I think that is one of the things that has eluded a lot of people, especially if you're just watching this through short clips on social media, is that those clips, which show off, I think, some of the weaknesses of the writing or the gameplay, don't really provide you what is the high points of this game and what it does really well, which is it creates scenes in which I felt very immersed in the environment. And because I could just be in these characters' bedrooms, it causes me to have memories of my own life when I was in a similar situation in my friends' houses in high school and how they were different or how, you know, they were creating these ideas of this road trip and they were planning it out with the pin board. And it caused me to remember my own experiences in California during this time, right? And so it is very much about taking it slowly and examining it. At the same time, it's presenting these magical realism, larger than life moments, which are not intended to be real. It's almost as if you are older and remembering the emotions about running through a field with your friends or driving along and listening to music while going to a party, of which I have very specific memories of, by the way. Hmm. So for me, it really captured the mood. And I think that's what you just can't get if you're not actually playing this game yourself, that its primary artistic merit is in creating the vibes and with the songs as well. And that is where this game is incredibly successful in my mind.
Yeah. And it is a game, to get that out there. It is a game because it uses interactive. And I will use the word challenges in the loosest of all terms, because there really aren't any actual challenges in this game. But the mechanics and the gameplay of the game don't exist to be challenges. They exist to, like you said, immerse you in a certain point in the storyline and enhance the emotional connection you have to what the characters are experiencing, the environment, and all that. And it does succeed very well with that. You mentioned the like jumping through the fields thing and all that, where like they're just running across a field to get to this, you know, abandoned house in the forest on the other side. But there's this, you know, the feeling of freedom, the feeling of like being on an adventure. It, you know, it makes sense that you'd feel like you're jumping and flying through. It feels very dreamlike. And so being able to act that out as the player enhances you and kind of like grounds you in that moment. Another one that I loved was the moment where she talks about her first kiss. And you have to use the two thumbsticks to maneuver the tongues.
That's very controversial, like, Doa. People hate that, by the way.
I think it's great. It is great because for so many reasons. One, because it's just really funny. But the other thing is that it perfectly embodies that awkwardness of like trying to kiss like that for the first time, where nobody knows what they're doing. So they're just kind of trying things. And of course, it's awful and disgusting and you know, really funny. And so having you like awkwardly use the thumbstick, making you do that, puts you in that uncomfortable position, which again grounds you in that extremely uncomfortable experience of that first awkward kiss. I thought it was brilliant. And I hated every second of it, but I thought it was brilliant.
People have hated that, Doa.
I hated it in a good way. Where I was like, oh, I'll make it stop. But
they just
hated
it in a bad way. But I agree with you. If we're talking about this game accomplishing its own goals, it is incredibly successful at duplicating that awkward first French kiss moment. And it's gross and uncomfortable. And one of them has braces and it's supposed to be gross and uncomfortable. And it goes on too long.
Yes,
I like how
exactly.
at the end, I think it just says like, that's enough.
Yeah, it just said, it's something like where it's like, like you have to keep going or like, or that's, you know, not enough. And then one of the words disappears and it's like, that's enough or like, let's quit or something. And it's, yeah, it's where it does, it gets to that point where it's like, okay, I guess we better stop now. Like, I don't, neither of us know what's happening here. But it was great. It was great. I think it was a brilliant way to, you know, to drive home the vibe as the millennials say. But yeah, I think people have a visceral gross out reaction to it, and they, you know, maybe that's what bothers them or something, because they don't like feeling uncomfortable in any situation. But it's like, in order to experience a well-told story, truly, you should be made uncomfortable at some point during that story, right? You know, you should be having emotions when you're experiencing a piece of media, or the piece of media probably isn't very good. Spoiler alert. So, you know, I think that scene is so great. That's one of the best moments in the game. And I couldn't wait for it to end, but I couldn't wait for it to end for the exact reason that I was supposed to, you know? So I really, really appreciated that part of it. I thought it was brilliant.
And also, I liked how immediately Stacy's friends are making fun of her for kissing this guy, which then ratchets up the awkwardness anyway, because she's having this memory of how strange this was. And then her friends are just drilling it into her that, this guy is kind of lame. And that theme just continues, because he's referenced at the party later as well, as I think they call him Lover Boy or something. So, you know, her friends are not letting either of these two people live this moment down, which
good friends would let you live that
exactly
down, you know. Yeah. during that era, I mean, like people like ate, slept and breathed insulting each other, and that was just like how friendships operated. I don't know, I'm not in any high school friendships right now, so I don't know the dynamic that's going on in 2026, but back in the 90s at least, like, you kind of just like made fun of each other the whole time. I would imagine it's not too different, honestly, but you know, who knows? You tell us in the comments below. What are your high school friend relationships like?
Yeah, and when, like, that's what this game, I think, really does well. And that it is not going to be communicated unless you are playing the game, which is a strong argument for it to be a game as opposed to a movie. You just won't have these. And I think part of it, too, is taking it slowly and being at your own pace in these environments and looking at things, and even stupid stuff like having the fish tank and tapping on the glass. There's an idleness to this game that leaves a lot of room just for personal reflection. And I think that's why when you look at this game, like, you're going to bounce off of it if there isn't an experience that vibes with you or an atmosphere that you really resonate with, because at its most powerful, this game makes you think about your own life. And I do think that the narrative has to be rather basic for that. And I do think that the narrative and the structure of the game is designed very intentionally to recall a lot of the media from that era, because the game is called Mixtape because it's about an audio mixtape, but it's also a visual and cinematic mixtape. It's a combination of a huge number of different references to things that you've already seen. And so when I was playing it, it's like I'm remembering my own life. I'm remembering watching The Breakfast Club when I was a teenager. I'm listening to this music and thinking about my own, when I had heard these songs for the first time, because I had heard many of them. And it really just immerses you in that moment. And this is a game that is just very uniquely personal. And that's what came across to me. I don't have a lot of experiences in gaming where I play a game and then I reflect on my own life. I don't think that happens very often.
Yeah. And it was like in a good way too, at least, you know, for me, it was like, I was just having a lot of fun remembering things, like the whole partying and then running from the cops and stuff. Like, my friend in rural Minnesota had like a grandparent that passed away. And so their house out on the country was abandoned. And so we just started partying in it. And one time it got busted. And so we all just scattered. And I remember like on my belly in the cornfield, you know, like hiding until the police went away.
Yeah.
And it's that stuff totally happens.
I had a similar experience, particularly with what I thought was the great scene where they trespass into the abandoned dinosaur theme park, which also, of course, brings in all of the Jurassic Park references visually. I thought it was really well done. But when it reminded me of how I used to go with my friends and trespass into outdoor public pools in the summer and like skinny dip with my friends. And one time the cops got called at like 1 a.m. while we were doing this, and we had to jump the fence naked and run from the cops.
Yeah, like, but you wouldn't have thought about that memory necessarily if you weren't playing this game and were like reminded of it. And like, that's why the slow pace of the game is so good, because it gives you a chance to sort of like take a moment or two and like remember that stuff and be like, oh man, I was so stupid. But that was exactly. So fun, you know.
And I think anybody at the time can identify with the quest for booze as well. It's like, well, how are we gonna get alcohol for this party, or how are we gonna get weed for this party? It's like, well, I know this dealer and I have to go over there, or I have a friend who's 21, or you know, I can steal some from my parents, and everybody's trying to scrape it together in order to make it happen. And this has been a common experience for teenagers forever, and it's represented in movies that are directly pretty much referenced visually and thematically, like Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused, which is an entire like mood piece film that is about kids trying to get alcohol to get a party. And people love that as a coming of age story. And I think that's what's missing, is that there is a group of people for whom, if you like John Hughes and you like Richard Linklater and you like Wes Anderson and you like David Lynch,
yeah,
you're going to really vibe with this, most likely.
Or and even things like Wayne's World, Mallrats, Airheads. There's like the
Bill
list
and Ted's
goes on.
Excellent Adventure, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, you know, it fits right in with all that kind of stuff. And like, even though it was made in 2026, I feel like it fits very well in like that pantheon, right? And it's cool that we have it in like gaming form, you know? So it was a really good experience. That said, I'm really surprised by the amount of 10 out of 10s it's been getting. Like, I think it was surprising. Good, but I do feel like a lot of reviewers were tricked by their own memories into rating this game based on their memories that were inspired by playing it versus the actual game. I will say that.
I totally agree, by the way, because if you have an emotional connection to this game, and it does create, in my experience, very powerful emotions. I think if you just put it down, it can be easy to not take a step back and be like, was it my own memories or was it the game itself? Mm-hmm. Right. And I think if you get confused by those moments that create those memories, and it doesn't allow you to look objectively at the actual quality of the game, which, you know, it has a John Hughes level story. And I also don't think that The Breakfast Club or Ferris Bueller's Day Off are 10 out of 10 movies.
Because I would agree.
They're just not written very well. Like the writing is adequate, but it's very one note. It's very flat. Mm. And for example, in this game, you know, you get the exact obvious cringe pivot you think you're going to get, which is the kids think the adults are being mean, but actually the adults have more dimension to them and they were once kids and liked music too.
Yep.
And I'm like, all right, okay.
And
which,
it's like,
by
again,
the way, is a total John Hughes moment.
Yeah,
right?
Totally.
And it's not high art as a result of that. And I think that's what's important to note, is that as a cinematic narrative game, it does the narrative okay. It does the environment and music and creating moments really well, but you can't say that this game is a 10 out of 10, which should be reserved for genre defining games that change games forever. And that's not what this game's going to do.
The pinnacle of video games, like in history, like a 10 out of 10 game should be something that only comes around every like 5 to 10 years, in my opinion. You know,
yeah,
if I was reviewing games, which I guess I kind of am, But if I was like doing it regularly and giving like number scores to things, I wouldn't give a 10 out of 10 to something, you know, unless it really, really, really did feel like something, an experience that I'll remember for the rest of my life, you know, kind of thing. So yeah, that's, it's a, I would, well, let's rate it. Let's rate Mixtape ourselves. Let's dive in to the controversy. I'll give it a 7.5 or 8 is about where I would place it, I think.
I gave it a 7. Like, I think it can be higher if you really vibe with it. You know, if I were to take my own personal experience with it, I'd probably rate it an 8, right? Mm. But I think why it got such high reviews, Stella, is that it's targeted at our demographic, which is very distinctly, you know, Gen X and millennial people.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a big part of it too. Is that like,
it is actually this
cultural experience is not, you know, universal to every common cultural experience that was existing in the 90s. We talk about it being safe and pleasant and all that. And there were certainly cultural groups in the 90s that did not have it so well in the United States.
Yeah, exactly.
So
there is that.
Yeah.
It is distinctly like a white middle class to upper middle class 90s and early 2000s experience. And like, that's who's going to vibe with it. And those are also the same people who are reviewing games for the most part. So I understand why when Mixtape does this really hard publicity push and they get it into the hands of journalists early who are this demographic, they know they're going to vibe with it. And they give away the very cool media kits that have like the custom Discmans in them with the same headphones from the game. It primes your nostalgia.
I feel like all that stuff should be banned from reviewers should not get gifts. I'm saying it right now. Like, this is why, like, you know, lobbyists causing all sorts of problems in government. I think giving gifts to reviewers, not a good thing for objective reviewing.
But it's not, because it primes you when you go into the game, you're like, wow, this is super cool. And this Discman reminds me of my own Discman from when I was kid, which it would have done for me as well, by the way. And so you're primed heading into this. And so I think that the reviewers were, you know, it's catnip to these people, right? It is this demographic. And so for my rating, I think it's fair, because it's for the right person. This is a great way to spend 3 hours. It really is. Like, you're going to have really powerful emotional moments, I think. And it does deserve a huge amount of praise for that, because that is not common in my experience in gaming. And if we want to take games seriously as art, or as part, you know, similar to the cinematic pantheon, right? There's a place for this game, and we should encourage more games like this to be made. It is ambitious by its very nature. It is connected to a bunch of previous films, you know, obviously the music itself, in a way that is much better designed from an artistic standpoint than most other games. But if you're a games reviewer and you're the right demo and you like games as art and you want to see, you desperately want to talk about games as having legitimate artistic merit, this game is really going to push all the buttons for you. But if you take a step back and you say, okay, well, let's actually talk about the narrative. Let's actually talk about the gameplay experience. It just can't be there, because on those two fronts in particular, it's not even as good as other walking simulator games. Like, What Remains of Edith Finch, to me, is still the pinnacle of the genre, has much better writing, has much better gameplay. I think it's, you know, but it doesn't have the same vibe, right? It didn't cause me to reflect on my own life. You are in the world of Edith Finch. In Mixtape, I'm in my own head half the time.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a really unique thing about this one, too, is I haven't had a game like kind of like get in my head that way, too, you know, which was a fun experience. You know, if you're kind of aware of what's going on, you know, while it's happening, you're like, oh, this is neat. I haven't played a game that's like really kind of like invoked these or evoked these like emotional responses before. It creates cool
space
thing
and
that
a room
that,
to have that experience is what it does well.
Yeah, and like just a little anecdotes on like all the stuff in the rooms and everything. Like, it builds storyline, but it also gives you such a great, you know, glimpse into these characters' brains, and then also reminds you of thoughts that you had that in some cases might have been very similar about various objects or music and things like that. One of the biggest shocks for me was that they included not one but two tracks from the 1986 Transformers the movie. Of course, Stan Bush's The Touch is you know, the one everyone knows, the big baseball scene one in this game, but they also started playing Dare when she was rescuing her friend from the cop car too. And I was so mad that they cut it off because that song is great. And what a waste. Only get the first 15 seconds of Dare. Stan Bush got robbed.
But
there.
this is also part of that nostalgia, because if you are Gen X or an older millennial, you remember seeing the Transformers animated movie.
And so it blew your mind because they killed Optimus Prime and Starscream and Megatron, sort of, and like a ton of other characters. Spoiler alert, by the way. But like, it just destroyed you as a kid that was into Transformers at that point emotionally. I'm still recovering from the emotional trauma of the Transformers film.
Well, 86. Also, you know, it's a great song, and it has all of these memories that people are going to attach to it because it's such an important part of that. It's so iconic to that film, right? Mm. And so I didn't know it was coming, Noah. So when I started playing the game and you get this baseball scene, which, by the way, is brilliantly constructed, where, you know, it gets more and more epic in their minds about how well Cassandra's doing at hitting baseballs and how good she is and showing the stadium and the jet flyover. But to have that song to start, I was just like, holy shit, like what a great moment. And I think that is what this game does, is it creates these moments that will just blow you away. If you understand the references that are being made, it is really good. And that song, The Touch, also, people might remember it from Boogie Nights, the Paul Thomas Anderson movie, which, again, this is another reference, where Mark Wahlberg is doing a cover of The Touch in that film.
I've never seen Boogie Nights.
I'm so sorry to hear that. Great movie.
I've heard. I didn't know The Touch was in that one.
It is. And it's there have been other movies and other media that have selected this song as well. So like that memory also comes back while I'm watching the scene. And, you know, it's this kind of intermixture of, okay, well, now it's a Paul Thomas Anderson, you know, reference, sort of. And it's a reference to this animated movie from our childhood. And it's such an interesting selection. And I think that's what makes us also trust Stacey Rockford's taste. Because she can be an annoying character, guys. And she is.
She is an extremely annoying character.
She's an extremely annoying character.
She's not very likable.
Don't get us wrong. Yep. But she does have good taste in music, and for a game that is supposed to be about her being a music supervisor and choosing the right songs for the moment, this game nails it time and time again, having atmosphere in there at the end too, from Joy Division, even starting with the Devo song. It just nails it. And, you know, I was really enjoying hearing some songs that I had never even heard before. The song that, I was reading some interviews with Johnny Galvatron, the director of this game, and he's, you know, this was made in Australia. So he picked some kind of Australian deep cuts, and the song where they're redoing the Ferris Bueller running scene, like they directly rip it at the end where she's trying to make it to the Heaven 11, aka 7-Eleven parking lot before the cops do. The song that sounds like a little bit like Bruce Springsteen there, I hadn't heard before, but it was a great selection. And people were complaining to, this wasn't the 90s music. It's like, no shit. Like,
you don't think we listened to things that were made in previous decades during the 90s? Like,
of course. But also, Doa, she would be an absolutely terrible music supervisor if she was just picking all the popular music of her day. The point is that she has knowledge to pick the popular tracks for the right moments, but also the unusual tracks that you might not have heard before that fit the scene perfectly. Like, and I think that is what the game absolutely nails.
Well, if somebody's complaining because the game set in the 90s doesn't only have 90s music, that tells you much more about their ability to critique media than the game itself, I believe.
I mean, the media literacy failure is just crazy with this. Like, the thing is that this just breached containment on the internet with a bunch of people who are never going to play this game, who were never even the target audience for this game. I had been watching this game's release because I had seen previews of it, and I was like, oh, this is interesting to me personally, right? So I was going to play this no matter what. I've been aware of this game for a long time, and I was interested in it. But then as soon as it launched, all of a sudden everybody on the internet's talking about it. And I was like, what the hell happened here? Wait, why is this game that should only be interested to me suddenly the topic of gaming conversation?
And I wasn't going to play it at all because I'm just generally not interested in the walking simulator type games. I like more like challenge, you know, mechanical challenge in my games, you know. But then I saw, you know, I heard a good review from you and I saw all the crazy controversy about it. And I'm like, all right, well, I got it. It's only 3 hours long. I got to at least give it a shot because I need to understand why people are going so crazy over this. And I ended up really liking it, you know, but I wouldn't have played it otherwise. So the controversy served me in that it gave me a chance to play this game that I really enjoyed.
I mean, I would have played it and told you to play it anyway, most likely.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, I think obviously this isn't, as we said, a perfect score, you know, earth-shattering gaming as a whole challenging game. But, you know, it is good and it has some very good moments. And for the time commitment you will spend with this game, which is 3 hours, and it's free on Xbox Game Pass, It's well worth your time,
right?
I think it's well worth your time.
Oh, for sure. And I think even if you don't want to dive into the nostalgic side of it too, I think it's a really cool like glimpse of that style of storytelling that was very prevalent back then. And it does really capture kind of like the vibe of, you know, that cultural experience that existed at that time. So I think, you know, from an anthropology perspective, if you're curious about, you know, how a certain group lived at a certain in a certain time period, I think it's a good example of that. If, you know, and obviously it's overblown, but it captures it, you know, it captures the vibe.
And I think anybody can relate to the abstract emotional experiences of it, right? And the stupid teenage conversations, because those haven't changed. The, you know, the fake philosophical depth, the saying a bunch of bullshit,
I'm 14,
occasionally,
this is deep, yeah.
but occasionally coming out with something really profound.
Sure,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe accidentally, out of the mouths of babes, as it were. Mm-hmm. You know, there are those moments where there's a lot of delusion and self-aggrandizement, but occasionally something really true ends up being said. Because these are people who are working through their own emotions and their own philosophical view of the world. And sometimes there is something profound that cuts through the jaded adult world in order to land. And I think it does that. You know, mm-hmm. I think that it does that. And you may not. The other thing that people were saying, though, is, oh, I don't like the characters. Like, you don't have to like the characters.
Yeah.
That's not the point.
They're not meant to be. I mean, really, I feel like none of the characters are truly meant to be likable. They're all very flawed characters, you know? I mean, he reminds me of, you know, some of my friends that I had in like high school and stuff that just accepted. They just decided they were never going to go anywhere in life and they were just going to stay in their little, you know, in these small towns and do, you know, whatever it was to get by. And like, you kind of know they're not probably going to be happy. You know, it's the people with like zero ambition, right? Which like, I know there's people out there and they're content to live those lives. But like, you know, I see that kind of person. I'm like, don't you want to do something? And I'm not saying do something to be rich and famous. I'm saying do something to do something, you know? I don't know how you can live without like making things, you know? So when I see people like that, I'm just like, I don't know. Just it doesn't compute, you know?
I do think, though, that Slater was having some character development at the end, though, because he lacked confidence.
His album, yeah.
Yeah, people say that Stacey Rockford is very unlikable. But in that moment, I found her to be very likable because she's trying to encourage her friend to explore his art and give him confidence in order to do that. No, the characters do have dimension and depth here. They're not all insufferable.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of her selfishness is just born from a lack of awareness, right? Like she just cancels on their big road trip because she finds something that's like very, very important to her. And like that importance to her kind of blinds her of like how that's going to affect the feelings of her friends. And that's a big part of the game is like her starting to understand that, you know, and she doesn't end up changing her mind. But, you know, what seems like kind of a jerk thing to do, which is kind of a jerk thing to do to bail on your road trip that you've been planning, it's totally natural for somebody that age to do something like that and not really be aware of how it's going to affect other people. You know, I found that to be very authentic, even if it wasn't likable, you know?
Yeah. And I do think that's where this game falls down in terms of narrative at the end, is that I really wanted there to be a character growth moment for Stacey Rockford where she realized, hey, you know, we spent all this time planning it. Everyone else, you know, my two other friends were excited about this. I'm excited about this, but her friends literally ask her, can't you just wait another week to go to New York? And she's like, no. I'm like, what the fuck? Like, that's so, you know, and her plan also is naive and stupid that she's, it's like a movie. She's just going to walk into some cafe and hand a mixtape to somebody. And then she's going to become this person's protege. Like, that's weird and creepy. And,
but, you know, I feel like that's fairly authentic to the experience too, because sometimes you just need to go out there and do something really, really stupid to get the lesson into your brain, you know, and maybe she as a person needs to go and do that. And then fail miserably and then have this realization and patch up all those relationships and all that. Sometimes people just need that, you know?
And I will also say that sometimes crazy plans like that actually work.
Yeah.
As well.
Very true. Very true.
You know, it seems naive, but like, you never know what this woman's like. You never know what that moment's going to be like. And there is a legitimate strength to people who are very passionate about something, putting themselves on the line in that way and like going after what they want.
I mean, so, I quit my job and bought a one-way ticket to South Korea to go commentate StarCraft II, and everyone in my life told me I was insane to do it. And, you know, maybe they were right, but like, it ended up working out, you know? So, you know, you really do never know when it comes to crazy things. And the thing I've always said is like, I like to use the phrase, normal's not going anywhere, where it's like, if you have this crazy idea, and why not, you know, if you can do it responsibly, if you're not hurting other people by pursuing it, why not go for it, right? Because what's the worst that can happen? You just get a normal job. Pretty much everybody has one of those, you know? So what do you really have to lose? You know, again, as long as you're not hurting other people by pursuing it, that's the big thing. But if you're not, what's stopping you? Just go for it.
Yeah. And I wish they had had a moment with Stacey at the end where she came to some level of self-awareness about what she had been doing, because, you know, this is a complicated scenario, and the fact that Cassandra is being petty and passive aggressive and inviting her nemesis, who, by the way, hilariously is just a nemesis for literally this world's stupidest, most petty reason in the first place, which
is she doesn't even seem like a bad person.
No, she doesn't. She's kind of an airhead, but it's like she didn't like, she wasn't paying attention to the music in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which is why Stacey hates her, which is like the pettiest, lamest, but most teenage reason of all
time.
It is
so, again, it's very authentic. And, you know, you don't like that there wasn't any character growth. I kind of like that there wasn't, because I feel like that to me felt more authentic, you know, where we just don't know. You know, did she grow or did she not grow? We don't know. And that's really what happens, you know, it with that age, right? You don't really know how people are going to end up, you know? So I felt like that was authentic, even though it may not have been meant to be that way in the writing. It might've just been kind of like poor writing, but at the same time, like, it really worked for me in terms of being authentic as far as people's trajectory in life.
I think I just at least wish that the climax hadn't been Cassandra confronting her father, because I felt that that storyline was introduced kind of late. You know, it sort of developed in the second half of the game, and it was a really like hilariously cringe confrontation, which it was supposed to be, by the way.
Yeah.
But it just felt weird that in a game that was primarily about the nature of this friendship and the importance of this road trip and what the changes were doing to that friend group, that it became all of a sudden focused on Cassandra's relationship with her family. That's what I didn't like most of all.
It was, I mean, I think it's like, oh, this is our, you know, this is our storyline that fits with all these other teen movies, you know, that's where, again, like you said, the adult ends up being more nuanced than you expect. You know, he has a reason to be, you know, very buttoned up because of his childhood and his family's experience in the 50s and all that. And, you know, and it really feels like he needs to be extra strict so that they fit into this community. Like, they give you a good understanding of why he is the way he is, you know. And so having the two of them come to that understanding is very typical of those kinds of stories. But yeah, I mean, I agree to a certain point, but I didn't feel as much, despite the fact that the game was called Mixtape and it was all about this other character's mixtape, I didn't have as strong of a feeling that she was distinctly the main character. I felt like she was the main character, but the other two in the party were supposed to be relatively close. And so her being a participant, but more of an observer than anything of the big final climax, felt it didn't feel as bad to me, but I can see why it would annoy you.
I just wanted to be focused on the three main characters' relationship. I wanted that to be the climax, not the Cassandra and her dad moment. That's my point.
Mm-hmm. But does what you want make it objectively good or bad? Wasn't that part of our whole discussion earlier?
I think it's better that way. And I think that it contributed to my opinion about the weakness of the narrative compared to the other parts of the game. I don't think the narrative is bad. Like, I don't think the writing is bad. I just found it to be kind of, I was lukewarm on it.
I think other people will find different.
Stronger.
Yeah, and I think other people that will find different things they liked or disliked about certain parts of the narrative, and a lot of that is probably influenced by their own memories that come up during the game too. That's what makes this game so weird, and I think so interesting to talk about, is that the memories it summons from your brain while you play it impact your feelings about different points in the story independently of the objective quality of the writing. Which is a very interesting thing for a game to do. So for that reason alone, it deserves, you know, praise. And I think there is a lot of discussion to be had about the story, and no one's going to be able to agree on it because it's going to be so different for everyone, you know?
Well, and that's why I referenced Richard Linklater, because it's his films, you know, like Dazed and Confused, the Before trilogy, as well, that they create these vibes. And Dazed and Confused really isn't about anything. It's a bunch of different small groups of small friend groups of teenagers all moving around this town on the last day of school before summer vacation, and then getting together, acquiring alcohol, and going to a party. And it's about these mundane conversations, and it's mostly about vibes. And when you watch Dazed and Confused, you're not really thinking about the characters because there's too many. But you're thinking about, hey, I knew a guy like that, or I remember this time when I went to this party. And that's what Linklater does. And I think people obviously bounce off of Richard Linklater's work too, but that's the kind of film he makes. And I think that part of the reason this is controversial is because there haven't been games like this that I'm aware of. And for that, I think it deserves to be lauded, because it creates this really interesting space. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's where this is interesting, because I've played a ton of the walking simulator games, and none of them have done this particular thing to me before, which I found really cool. And so if you're looking for a unique gaming experience, this is certainly one of those.
Yeah. Unique is definitely the number one word I would use to describe this game. You know, there's nothing else quite like it. And again, it's not genre defining. It's not a 10 out of 10, but it is a very unique experience. And I think it's very good. I would recommend everybody play it. You know, whether or not you would vibe with the nostalgia aspect of it.
Well, I also think it's just important to support games like this, because even if you don't like this particular game, having games that take themselves seriously as artistic projects and are connected to the wider artistic world of cinema and music, I think is important because, okay, you don't vibe with this one, but the next game that comes out like this, you may heavily fuck with.
Totally.
And you know, you might not get that game otherwise. Like, that's why I would like this to be a success. And also, I think it's very weird, Doa, the way that people have approached criticizing this game because of who's behind it. So,
yes,
you know, Megan Ellison, who's the daughter of Larry Ellison, the Oracle billionaire, right? And suddenly they attack Annapurna Interactive, which, by the way, has been around for over a decade at this point in time and has published games like What Remains of Edith Finch, Stray, Cocoon, Outer Wilds. Would we even have these games if Annapurna Interactive wasn't putting money behind it? They're pretty much like the A24 of gaming, where they find auteurs or development companies who have really cool out-of-the-box ideas, and they actually put money behind them to make them good.
Well,
this game can't exist without a budget of millions of dollars just for music licensing rights.
Yeah. Well, I had the same thought on this too, where, you know, you can think of a lot of bad things that billionaires do, but supporting the arts,
including Larry Ellison, by the way.
Yes, exactly. You know, and
if I have to
supporting
choose between
the arts
does Larry
is something
Ellison
that, well,
finance the
doing.
Israeli military or mixtape, I choose mixtape.
I mean, if you go, I'm a big fan of like the Renaissance, and back then a lot of rich people would just you know, hire artists to make lots of great art. Wouldn't that be nice if that was like a huge trend, that we had all these like hyper wealthy people funding the arts a lot more, you know? That'd be nice. So when that happens, when someone very wealthy does fund the arts in a way, I don't think we should be complaining about that.
Well, also
that part of it I'm okay with.
You know, she also, Megan Ellison also created Annapurna Pictures and has produced a bunch of really good movies, including Her, Foxcatcher, Phantom Thread, so another Paul Thomas Anderson film. And would these films be getting made? Like, she legitimately seems to actually care about putting money towards art and giving artists a chance to express themselves. And why are we criticizing the devs for taking money to license music so that they could actually create an ambitious musically driven title, which in my opinion uses the music extremely well? I would much rather have money go to activating these people's artistic ambitions, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what's so weird, is that people are saying, oh, it's an industry plant. It's like, no, it's a rich person allowing other people to realize their artistic visions. And then what's the crime here, though? Is it publicizing it, like saying,
I don't know, I think
like spending money on advertising. I don't really understand what the complaint is, because if she wastes her money making this game but I still enjoy it, who gives a fuck?
I mean, I think there's a little bit of you know, speaking of youth, maybe I think there's a little bit of naivety in that, like, it's, you know, we don't like billionaires. Billionaires do terrible things. Therefore, everything a rich person does is bad. And, you know, that's kind of painting with too broad of a brush, I think, where certainly, like I said, there's lots and lots of things that billionaires are doing right now that are very, very bad for us. But that doesn't mean every single thing every wealthy person does is bad. So, you know, again, what do we want? A little bit of nuance, right? So.
When do we want it? Yesterday.
Someday. The far future, the distant future.
But yeah, that by far has been, I think, the most bizarre aspect of this is, like, it also wasn't a secret. Like, I knew Megan Ellison was involved in Annapurna Interactive forever. And it's like, yeah, I cared. I didn't care because she was just making good games and good movies. And so I support her efforts with Annapurna. And I don't really understand what the complaint is here. It's like, rich person spends their money to make art.
Well, here's the thing. If you feel that way about this game, then you are not allowed to be excited about Grogu. All right. Like, you can't be like, Star Wars Day. Hooray. Yeah, that's Disney, guys. Like, you can't like knock one thing like that and then get into something else. Like, you have to, you know, again, you're going to stop ordering Amazon packages. You know, what are you going to do to show me your dedication to the cause?
Well, I just don't even understand why this is remotely a scandal, because it's, you know, if she had been hiding her involvement, OK, maybe like if this turned out to be some sort of. So I think people are pissed because they're mad that the indie label gets applied to these games. But it's just objectively true that Beethoven and Dinosaur is an independent game studio. They just happen to have a lot of money. And I get people are angry because, like, Dave the Diver had the same thing where it's like Mint Rocket was actually part of Nexon. And so it's getting, you know, Dave the Diver is getting nominated for indie game awards that we think, OK, this should be going to those starving artists who are like grinding out in a two-person team a game for 6 years.
Hey,
right,
who's gonna wait till they find out that these small game companies go out and they try to raise as much money as possible for their company? What you mean they're not just like working off of Patreon subs and tip charts? Are actually doing fundraising rounds? VC, what? How dare they?
Well, I think that's what people are pissed about, is that the indie label is applied to these games that have lots of money, either through VC or publishers. And they're presented as the same thing as the starving artist who worked for 6 years, you know.
Well, sure. I think there's a conversation about like what is the definition of indie game? You know, maybe
yeah,
there's
and
an
I think people
of that conversation
people object because it feels sure. manipulative, because when we hear indie, we're supposed to support the creators, and it's used in order to cause people to spend money to support things. And so I understand that it can feel disingenuous, but like it is technically the correct word to use for these things. What we need is, you know, just calling them what they are, which is AA titles. This is a AA title. And I also think people love the other controversy, Dylan, that's been swirling that I haven't addressed, is that people are saying, oh my God, I can't believe they got the music rights in perpetuity. First off, these are old songs.
It's The Touch by Stan Bush, guys.
Yeah, I'm
I don't
sure
think
it
there's
costs
a huge
money.
Amount of clamoring, you know, for that. It's a great song, but I don't think everyone's out to license it right now.
Yes. You know, there'd be a different conversation if this was Hey Jude. You know what I mean? These are songs, even by, let's take the Smashing Pumpkin. Love is not the biggest Smashing Pumpkins song by a long shot, right? You're talking about some post-punk bands. And yes, people know The Cure and Joy Division, but they're not...
Devo.
Yeah, obviously people know Devo. I mean, those are probably more expensive, right? But as somebody personally who has licensed music, because I produced esports events, and I personally was working with bands like Bring Me the Horizon, I can just tell you that it's probably cheaper than you think it is. Did this game probably throw a couple million at music licensing? Yes. Did it throw 20 million? No. It doesn't cost $1 million to license the songs in this game, right? Certainly not the Australian songs. Certainly, you know, the other deep cuts that are here. There are basically, it's a combination of known songs, but not the most known songs by some kind of like B tier bands. And then like an S tier band, like Smashing Pumpkins, like not their most famous song, right? So I do think the music rights in perpetuity have been incredibly overblown. And then it's used as a cudgel to beat up the game by saying it's not really indie because they had all this money, which is purely speculative in the first place. Like, I think from a business perspective, Annapurna Interactive is not so stupid that they look at this game and they say, this is for a niche audience. What are the realistic sales figures of this? And I'd have to think, Doa, it's probably beating their expectations in terms of sales. Yeah, because
probably
of all the controversy.
Now, yeah. But I wouldn't... I wonder if you even, I mean, I think you hope every game makes a profit, but it's kind of funny to think with all that licensing that this game, you know, would be hugely profitable, you know, because again, it is targeted for a very niche audience. So that combined with the cost that went into making it does make you wonder, you know, how much return they were expecting really with it.
And also maybe Megan Ellison decided that she doesn't care about losing money on this game.
If you have infinity money, it's not, you know, a huge deal to just have a game made that you like, you know?
And if she likes it and she wanted it to be made by being a art patron of the arts, you know, but honestly, Doa, like, I think what is not being said here is that there's a large group of people who actually do like this game, because in spite of all the controversy, it has 3,000 Steam reviews, which are overall positive. It is an overall positively reviewed game. It has not been review bombed. Certainly some people don't like it. Certainly some of these complaints are valid. But, you know, it has 3,000 Steam reviews. And as I understand it, the typical Steam review to sales is for every one review, there's 55 sales. And that's just on Steam. And that's just on Steam. It's not on PlayStation. It's not on where I played it, which was Xbox Game Pass. I think you played it on Xbox Game Pass as well.
Yep.
So I think probably most people, like the largest number of people probably played it on Xbox Game Pass, and Xbox will hand money to Baytone and Dinosaur and Annapurna Interactive to basically license it for Game Pass on day one. So if you look at this, like, is this game, if this game makes $5 to $10 million, does it turn a profit? The answer is probably yes, I would imagine. And so it just has to be the right game. And it's also a game that's not going to be like as it goes on sale, as more people hear about it, this is going to be passed by word of mouth. I would not have expected a smash hit out of the gates for this game, because let's pretend this controversy didn't exist, Doa. What would have happened is I was definitely going to play this game. I would have played this game, and then I would have recommended it to you, and you would have played this game.
Yeah, probably. And yeah, I mean, I certainly would have been a beneficiary of word of mouth promotion for this game, because
yes.
It flew past my radar. I didn't know it was coming out. I hadn't even, like, I don't recall even hearing about it until you brought it up. And then you're like, oh, there's this game, and there's all this controversy around it. And so then I kind of looked up. I'm like, okay, well, I mean, the thing that got me to play was you said it was only 3 hours long. And I'm like, well, I can at least put 3 hours into this. You know?
I told you it was 3 hours long and it was free on Xbox Game Pass.
Yeah. And I was like, short and free? Sign me up. You know, that's my gaming life right now with a toddler at home. So yeah, it ended up working out just fine. I'm glad I played it.
Yeah.
But definitely a word of mouth thing for me.
But I think that that would have been true for a lot of people, is that this game kind of would have slowly rolled out via word of mouth. You know, I think this game actually got hindered by the fact that it had a lot of money for publicity, because it allowed them to do the special press kits. It allowed them to promote all of the, in my opinion, erroneous scores around this game, because all of a sudden they're posting all these graphics on social media. It was like 10 out of 10 from 12 different publications and all these quotes. And, you know, what they're, you know, what's funny though, is how they're treating this is like you promote a film, which, surprise, surprise, Annapurna Pictures is used to doing. Like, it's probably, honestly, Noah, it's probably the same group of people who promote their films that's promoting this game. And maybe that's why it feels disingenuous, because that sort of like scoreboard is what you see from movies, right? And these press kits are what you see from movies, and courting the influencers is what you see from movies. But that's just how it's done. And maybe they misread the room and it caused people to be mad. But I also just don't think, Doa, that any of the people who are mad about this game were ever going to play it.
Sure, sure. Yeah, and I mean, like, I won't begrudge people for marketing their product. You know, I don't think it's wrong to send out, like, gift packs to people with that. But I think in the terms of pure reviewing, pure objective critiquing, it's wrong to, you know, receive it and let it influence you.
Here's an idea, Doa.
Throw it in the trash. Put on
eBay. No, just open it after you finish the game.
Oh, yeah, that too. Yeah, yeah, sure. You
just
can do
open
that too.
It after you reviewed the game. Just
right.
Open it later.
You made it way simpler than I did. Yeah, just do that later. Yep. Just play the game. Going cold. I didn't watch any of the trailers for this game going into it. So I had no idea what the game even looked like before I turned it on. And I'm really glad about that, because I got to experience it in the most purest form, where all I had heard from you is that it was short, it was making people mad, and it was good. And I was like, great, let's go for it, you know? And so, you know, I got to go into it completely fresh, which is awesome. And so I feel bad for people trying to review games and not getting to go in like that. You know, you don't get a real experience.
So if any of this sounds attractive to you about the game, it's probably for you. And it is for a group of people. And those people, contrary to what you hear on the internet, are not cringe millennials who want to relive their teenage experience. Like, I don't.
Sounds like something some Zoomer would say that wasn't even out of their high school experience yet.
That's right. That sounds like somebody who's still having a high school experience. Oh, man. That, yeah. But I think if you are curious about this time period and curious about what I think is a rather ambitious artistic attempt to not only create a game based around music and vibes, but also draw in a bunch of film references. It's, you know, I admire its ambition. I don't think it's flawless. I don't think it lives up to everything that it attempts to do, but it's good. It is just, it's just a good game.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you have Game Pass, you literally have zero reason to not play it. And if you don't, I mean, it's still probably not I don't know what it costs on Steam or whatever. It's probably not that much. I don't know. What is on Steam? Like, 20
18 bucks, I think.
30, yeah, whatever. It's like, like I said, standard, like, double A level game, you know. That's fine. People are paying like $70 for Tomodachi Life.
I paid $70 for Pragmata, which, you know, Pragmata was a similar experience in that I also thought it was a 7 out of 10. It had much better gameplay. Pragmata has sick gameplay, had an ass storyline though, like, you know. So I look back, Noah, and I don't think, wow, I had so much more fun playing Pragmata than Mixtape. I didn't.
Mm. Interesting. Interesting.
I just appreciated them for different reasons. And also, I don't really care because I was going to go to the movie theater to have a cinematic experience. I'd be spending the same amount of money as I did to get to play Mixtape, right?
Fair enough. And so, you're going to be going to the cinema quite soon to catch the film Mandalorian and Grogu.
Great. Oh,
yes. I'm seeing it the day after tomorrow.
Well, you guys could go check out the Last Free Nation Movies channel for that.
Go do that.
Thrilling review that Doa and I will be doing there as well.
We have mixed opinions about Star Wars.
if you guys enjoy this content, obviously subscribe here. Subscribe to the Elephant Movies channel as well. And we'll be back for more gaming deep dives on Post Game Clarity. See you then.